the topic tonight, I think the title we chose, the distribution of wealth, how the system makes us poor and them rich. It's no wonder they don't talk about it here. Anyway, our first speaker is Andrew Fisher, who's the director of Left Economics Advisory Panel and the author of The Failed Experiment. Copies here available for a price. Andrew.
Hi. Firstly, say thanks to John for inviting me onto this panel. It's a really good panel. I've read books by Mariana and by Danny. I'm a big fan of Jenny, so I'm a bit of a, probably like most of you, a fan of the other people on the panel. I think the premise of this meeting is slightly wrong. I mean, I think it ignores the simple fact that, you know, the trickle-down effect means that this doesn't matter. thank you for that. Before you realise I was joking. Because I'm glad people did laugh, because the premise of the trickle-down effect is basically if you put all the money in the wrong place, it will end up in the right place. That's what it means, the trickle-down effect. And in fact, we know we don't have a trickle-down effect. In fact, we have the opposite. We have a vacuum effect that sucks money up to the people at the top. That's what our economy is designed to do. It's what it does very well and the structure it's inbuilt. If you've ever played the board game Monopoly, then after 2 or 3 hours of tears, recriminations, children wailing at the brutality of it, there we are, someone else has had that experience, maybe at Christmas or something, you know what happens, don't you? You get to the last knockings, and even though you start off equal, everyone gets £200 for passing go, what happens at the end is one bugger ends up with all the money and all the property, and everyone else is bankrupt, and if you have somebody particularly smug, they make you work to the very end, selling your houses and your hotels back to the bank, mortgaging your property, and just rinsing every last pound out of you. And sometimes, and the economy feels a bit like that, I think, for a lot of people at the moment, and it's miserable. I said that inequality is systematic, it's structured, it's inbuilt within the economy. I just want to talk about what I mean by that. I want to talk about 5 ways in which I think it is. First is taxation, and if we look at how the burden of taxation has shifted just in my lifetime, I'm 35 years old, so you've got some parameters of that. The burden of tax shift away from income and onto consumption. We've seen tax shift away from corporations and onto the individual. And I just want to briefly quote you some stats. So from 1979, 35 years ago or so, the poorest 10% of the population paid 35% of their incomes in tax. And the richest 10% paid 37%. Now, after 18 years of Conservative government in 1997, that had changed to the poorest 10% paying 44% of their incomes in tax, and the richest paying only 34%. So you've seen a shift, a massive shift, in who pays proportionately the most tax. So we think of our tax system as being progressive, as redistributing wealth. In fact, it doesn't. It reinforces inequality because of that shift onto consumption and indirect taxation. Likewise, corporation tax in 1979 was 52%. From April this year, so from next month, it will be 20%. The lowest by a mile in the G7. So of all the biggest economies, ours would be the lowest by a mile. By the way, it was the lowest already when George Osborne came in when it was 28%. It was the lowest when the Conservatives left office in 1997 when it was 33%. So we've seen corporation tax just drop in a way that other taxation hasn't. And in fact, in quite an opposite way to things like VAT has done. The labour market. Now, there's a research by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, the authors of The Spirit Level, that shows over time, across countries, there is a very clear relationship between trade union membership and levels of equality. The higher the trade union membership, higher the levels of equality in a country. That's true in the UK. It's true across the developed world. And what we've seen in the UK, again, the biggest labour market, biggest levels of employment we've ever had in this country currently, but actually we only have 6.5 million trade union members. A generation ago, it was double that. The number of workers covered by collective bargaining agreements, which means trade unions negotiate for wages collectively, has gone from 85% back then to under a quarter of workers have their wages negotiated in that way. Now, for a long time, since the 70s, the share of our national wealth going to wages has been dropping. And in the last 7 or 8 years since the crash, we've actually seen real terms drops in terms of what people's wages are. So we're seeing an intensification of this process, that wages are making up a smaller part of the economy. And we notice it, because when we talk about exploitation in the labour market, we talk about things like the increase in agency workers, the increase of 0 hours contracts, the prevalence of things called apprenticeships, which are no such thing as an apprenticeship, what you or I would think of as an apprenticeship, which is a learning a skills trade that takes years of on-the-job experience. The number one provider of apprenticeships in 2012 was Morrisons. Now, I'm not denigrating anybody who works in the supermarket on a till. I had friends who did it at university, but they learned the job within a week. It wasn't an apprenticeship. My wife, on the other hand, was an engineer for BT for a year. That took a lot of training. She's got a skill that was transferable at the end of it. That's an apprenticeship. But what we have now is Subway, the sandwich shop. Again, nothing against it. They make very nice sandwiches. That's not an advertisement. I just happen to like them. But they are advertising apprenticeships for sandwich artists. Now, why are they doing that? Now, they generally have a nice presentation. I'm not knocking it. But why are they doing that? Because you can pay somebody on an apprenticeship £2.73 an hour. So you undercut the minimum wage. This is on top of the 5 million people who are in regular work earning less than the living wage already. There's a meeting down this hall tonight about National Gallery workers protecting works of art worth millions of pounds who aren't even paid the London living wage. And then, of course, you've got workfare. If you're on welfare now and you're unemployed for more than 6 months, if you're reps enough to be under 25 or over a year, if you're a bit older, then you're put on workfare. You're forced to work for your benefits. To work at an effective rate of about £1.93 an hour, stacking shelves at Poundland or something else. So the labour market reinforces this inequality of structure. Housing, now I'm sure Danny Dorling will speak more about this. I've just finished reading his book and it's brilliant, all very solid. And there'll be a review going up on my site very soon to that effect. So I won't linger on this, but actually if you look at the rise of the private rented sector, it shows two things. Number one, we haven't built council housing. The number of people who lived in council housing a generation ago was about 30% of the population. It's now down to about 10%. And actually, for the first time since the end of the Second World War, over the last 5 or 10 years, home ownership's actually been falling as well because people are priced out. And so the rise of the private rented sector is because houses have become an asset class. They're an investment opportunity. They're not about homes. Now, housing is a right, fundamental right, especially in a country like Britain where it's cold and it's raining. You know, housing is an essential good, but it's been increasingly shoved into the market and taken out of the realm of rights. And so we see evictions from private rented sector at a record high. Homelessness has gone up 62% under this government. Astonishing. But why is that? Because people are able to inflate housing prices, and George Osborne is actively encouraging it, budget after budget, Help to Buy, Help to Buy ISA, and every other step he's doing, and resisting things like the mansion tax and other policies, or land value tax that would actually tackle that. The fourth thing I want to talk about is privatisation, which is less intuitively obvious, I think, than some of the other things, than housing, the labour market and taxation. But actually what we do when we privatise things is we place goods like water, energy, transport, out of the realm of these are goods, these are socially public goods, and into the realm of this is something to make money out of. And if we look at the railways as one of the most gratuitous examples, the level of public subsidy going into the privatised railways now is twice as high as it was when it was under British Rail. So when it was publicly owned, we were putting in half as much subsidy as we're now giving to private franchises to run it. Now that's meant £11 billion worth in dividends has gone to the shareholders of those private rail companies since it was privatised. An astonishing amount of money. We have the most expensive rail fares in Europe. Our rail fares go up every year above inflation. So this is redistributing wealth away from the average person who travels on the train up to the owner, the capitalist in old speak, if you like. And it's the same everywhere. Thames Water, the same. Inherited its infrastructure on the cheap when it was privatised at the end of the 80s, and yet made £273 million worth in profit last year, didn't pay a penny in corporation tax. And just to add insult to injury, its finance director told its meeting of shareholders that we don't intend to for the next 10 years. Why don't they intend to? Not because they've put it on the Cayman Islands or anything like that. It's because that infrastructure they've got is now in need of urgent renewal, and they've got a scheme with the government where it's completely offset. So for years, having hiked up water prices in the first 10 years of privatisation, 40% above inflation, they are now having to renew the infrastructure that they didn't spend their profits on in the first place. So we are paying for, again, our water prices aren't going down, they're going up above inflation, and we are paying for them, the taxpayers losing out so that they can renew infrastructure they got on the cheap in the first place. It's astonishing. So what we see is money being shifted into higher bills, whether it's in energy or water or rail, and more dividends and higher salaries for the people at the top. And I guess the thing that ties all this together is effectively the financialisation of our economy. And we see it most gratuitously, I think, with private equity companies. Boots is a good example. I mean, Stefano Messina is probably a name not known to many people before he was on the media saying that Labour would be a disaster. Now, whether you agree with that position or not, it's a bit rich coming from somebody who's taken a British company that's historically based in Nottingham, put it in a canton of Switzerland called Zug to avoid paying any tax, is a non-domiciled person himself, so avoids paying tax, and he's worried about Labour taxing too much. I mean, you've got to admire the direct connection, I suppose, but it's a little bit ironic. But that's how private equity views that, you know, companies can just be picked up, assets stripped, workers laid off. By the way, they've laid off several thousand workers since it was taken into private equity. So the idea that they're some sort of wealth creator, job creator within the UK is pretty much of a farce, really. But the problem is, our only industrial strategy over the last 35 years has been whatever the city council attends their wants. That's been Britain's industrial strategy for 35 years, broadly speaking. And I don't want to be unbiased about this, so let me just quote Gordon Brown. 10 years as Chancellor, this was in 2007, he said this. He was speaking to the City of London in that lovely white tie dinner you see, that, you know, they're on the throne, there's all that golden cutlery, and, you know, it's just sort of ostentatious greed of the rich lording it over the rest of us. There was Gordon Brown addressing all these banks in the City of London and saying, now today, over 40%, I won't do the accent, now today, over 40% of the world's foreign equities are traded here, more than New York. Over 30% of the world's currency exchanges take place here, more than New York and Tokyo combined. While New York and Tokyo are reliant mainly on their large American and Asian domestic markets, 80% of our business is international. And in a study last week of the top 50 financial cities, the City of London came first. I don't know about you, but none of that makes me feel particularly proud. I don't think, oh, that's great, that's a good thing for our nation. Of course, 3 months later, it all started crashing. So he'd actually say it was the beginning of a new golden age for the city. Maybe it was a bit redder than we think. But I think what all that tells us is that structurally, the government has been asleep at the wheel. In fact, I don't think it's even been asleep at the wheel. I think it gave the wheel to somebody else to run, and that wheel's the economy. And if the thing is, if you let rip in a free market, then this is what happens. Inequality happens. Trickle-down doesn't happen. We know that. The inequality statistics tell us that. But it affects us. And I think we have to recognise that fundamentally the problem of the economy is, you know, I'm all for a bit of glib bank bashing, by the way, so don't take me as being anti that. But actually the fundamental problem is inequality. This is structural. This isn't just about a few reckless bankers did something dodgy once and the economy crashed. This is far deeper than that. And it affects our housing market, our taxation system, our labour market and everything else. We need a democratic economy, and that means an economy as if people matter, not whether profits are up or down, not whether the FTSE index is up or down. Those things fundamentally don't matter. What matters is whether people have a job. Are we becoming more or less unequal? Can people afford to keep a roof over their heads? Because I, for one, think it's quite ironic that the welfare state now is effectively propping up high rent and low-paying employers. Because the reason Ian Duncan Smith hasn't met his targets to cut benefits is nothing to do with his you know, ballsing it up, although there's been a bit of that as well if you look at universal credit. It's predominantly because housing benefit has been shooting up and tax credits have been shooting up because we haven't restructured the economy. We haven't got control of the labour market or of the housing market. And these things will happen. So I think we do need to look at things like taxing wealth, of which the mansion tax is a very small and insufficient step, but it's a step in the right direction. I think we need to cap the ownership of housing. I'm sorry, I don't think you've got a right to own 40,000 houses or 50 houses or have a portfolio of housing when some people haven't even got one. Sorry, it's a social good. It's not just an asset class. It's not like owning gold or artworks or you know, antiques. You know, it's more important than that. A living wage, trade union rights, an industrial strategy, as I mentioned at the end. And yes, public ownership, but not public ownership for its own sake. public ownership so that we can drive an economy that invests in those sort of things. Because actually, if you look at it, especially in areas like renewable energy and public transport, Britain is like, you know, is lagged behind the rest of the world. We're like, as Gordon Brown said, we rank number one for tax business competitiveness or in the top few. But when it comes to infrastructure, we're 24th, according to the World Bank. Why? Because we've privatised it all, and it's just being asset stripped. They're not investing in it. You look at around the world at the infrastructure available now in public transport and on renewable energy, Britain is miles behind. And that's because we haven't got a strategy, a coordinated strategy, that invests in these things and prioritises. So that, if you like, is my take on how the system makes us poor and then rich.
Our next speaker is Baroness Jenny Jones. She's a Green Party member of the House of Lords. Jenny.
Thank you very much. And only Green member of the House of Lords. I was very excited when I got the invitation to speak this evening because it said in the blurb, that John had started an initiative called the People's Parliament in the hope of using the meeting rooms within Parliament to bring some real politics to Parliament. I think that's absolutely brilliant, so well done for that. I am sitting in the House of Lords, but I'm also on the London Assembly, and as such, I've been up close and personal with Boris Johnson for the past 7 years, and I've got to tell you that here in London, a lot of the problems that Andrew's already covered, thanks, actually do come from what I would say are some rather nasty policies that Boris is extremely happy to promote. One of them, of course, is about the living wage, and the second one is about housing. And I think there's a lot of politicians who think the same way, and they need to be constantly challenged. I'm a practical politician. I like answers. I like practical measures to push through. Earlier in the Lords, there was an oral question about air pollution. What the government and what the Mayor of London were doing about it. And I said, wouldn't it have been better last Tuesday when we had a really bad air pollution episode here in London? Instead of the Mayor asking people to stay at home and stay indoors, wouldn't it have been better for the drivers of high polluting vehicles to stay at home? And everybody laughed, as if I'm making a joke. As if, I mean, I thought it was a very practical proposition, but the majority of people in the House of Lords thought that I was joking. Now, The thing about the living wage is that here in London we do have a moderately decent living wage. And it's true that Boris Johnson has promoted it and promoted it a lot. But the way in which he's promoted it is to make it a voluntary thing. He has not at any stage tried to put pressure on people to sign up to this. He has not lobbied the government to make it mandatory to pay the living wage. We do, through the GLA, the Greater London Authority, we do in fact only take contractors who pay the London living wage, so we are doing a little bit of our own. But the fact is, of course, that very, very few companies want to pay the living wage. A few do, and I think Boris has signed up, he has signed up nearly 400, which isn't bad until you realise there's tens of thousands of businesses in London that could sign up to the living wage but haven't. And he has, you'll forgive me if I'm known about Boris all the time, he's down here in this committee corridor this evening. I feel like going in and throwing bits of paper or something heavier. And he does say the right things, and you think, come on, I won that argument, you know, he's going to go all out and support the living wage. And then actually he defends it as a voluntary decision. When he was elected in 2008, there were an estimated nearly 600,000 Londoners earning less than a living wage. And now it's well over 900,000. So in fact, the poor are getting poorer. And it is almost inevitable. I agree with everything that Andrew said, apart from his opening remarks about the trickle-down effect, which I think we can all agree was a joke. And the fact is that no major retailer has actually signed up to the living wage. And I'll cite, for example, John Lewis. I like John Lewis, I like the fact it's a cooperative, but it outsources its cleaners, and it does not stipulate in the contracts that those cleaners should be paid the living wage. I think that, coming from a company that talks all the time, takes the moral high ground about its ethical business practices, I think that's very, very shabby. And I keep writing to them and they keep saying that's not our decision, that's something, but of course it is. And as Andrew said as well, the minute that we allow businesses not to pay a wage that people can actually build a life on, we are subsidising them through the welfare system. And then of course the right-wing people in this parliament say that, oh, there's too many people on benefits. I have actually successfully argued with some right-wing friends, and I do have right-wing friends, a lot more than I'm in the Lords, and to say to them, sure, it can't be right to subsidise unviable companies by paying the welfare bill. And sometimes it clicks and they do actually suggest that that's probably not a good idea. And Boris did, he supported a Green proposal at City Hall to try to limit pay inequality within City Hall. Greens as well feel that there should be quite strict pay ratios. We feel that whatever you pay the top person in your company, you should be paying the bottom person at least 10%. Now, I think that's logical, isn't it? It means that we're not saying you can't pay people a lot of money if you think they're really worth it. But I think cleaners and people who push the tea trolley around are actually worth 10% of what you pay the top person. If you want to tie a company together and make it actually an effective company. And I'm afraid Boris has actually supported the super rich. And he's lobbied the European Commission several times on behalf of bankers, but never about any of the things that I care about. Never about the environment, never about issues of inequality. He has spoken of a new age of philanthropy, of the super rich voluntarily supporting the less well off. But in fact, that sort of charitable donation has no near made up for the amount lost in the austerity cuts. And then, of course, the second really bad idea that is happening here in London is the idea that we will solve our housing crisis by getting more investment into supply. And it's exactly as Andrew has said, that houses are being built, but they can't be built unless developers can be sure that many of them are sold off plan before they're actually built to investors from other places. These are often people from outside London, and they are people who are investing in the houses. That means there's fewer houses for people who actually need to live in them, and so on. I think that it's a case of seeing that the right thing to do is to build housing, and most of us would agree that that's a very sensible idea. But at the same time, not understanding why you're building them. You're not necessarily building them here in London to make loads of money. You're actually building them so that people can live in them, so that you have fewer homeless and fewer people who are struggling. Those investors as well, of course, they drive up prices. I mean, I think housing in London, I think we're like twice the national,
yep.
Something like twice the national average at the moment. And so they, as these investors buy the houses, they push up the prices, which means that people on ordinary salaries actually have to pay private rents. They can't afford to buy. And those private rents are getting higher and higher as well. So we're into a sort of slow spiral at the moment, which is making life harder for many, many Londoners. Investors apparently buy an estimated 2/3 of new homes in London. 2/3! That's people who are investing, they're not living in them, they just want to, you know, to keep them as an asset. And this is the big problem when houses are seen as an asset. And the other third, and these are very rough figures, but I can get them for you if you want, that the other third of the housing is bought by the richest fifth of the population who can still afford the prices. Now in London, of course, there's lots of well-paid people who can afford those prices, but even so, it means that somebody on the average salary absolutely can't. We could use taxation to prevent this. We could do all sorts of things. I've got a bill in the Lords at the moment that's sitting very sadly on a list of bills that are now going to actually be debated on land value taxation, which I think is something that many of us to the left of politics would like to see happen, because it's a very efficient way of making sure that properties and land and so on is valued properly, and it's not only what you've got on top of it. And I feel personally that London has got much, much worse over the past decade. And it seems that when London gets worse, for whatever reason, because the South East is heating up, It not only makes life more difficult for those of us who live in London, but it also affects the rest of Britain. It sucks a lot of wealth down into this area, which is inherently unhealthy because it means the economy becomes unbalanced. And it means also you get these very stupid ideas about high-speed trains that are going to change everything. They're going to make it so much easier to get to Birmingham and places like that. and of course, we know what happens is it benefits London, and it probably won't benefit anywhere north of the M25. For me, as somebody, I mean, I now feel incredibly privileged. I mean, not in terms of the money I earn necessarily, although I like paying tax because it means I earn enough to actually pay tax, and secondly, it means that I'm paying for a society that I want to live in. But I do own my own place. Admittedly, I bought it in a really scummy part of, oh, I shouldn't say that, should I? In a very downhill part of London a long, long time ago, and never really had enough money to do it up properly. But the fact is, we are becoming rarer, those of us who can afford houses. Most of the younger people I know are being driven out far outside. And of course, if you're on low income, you have to live a long way out. That means you spend longer travelling, it means you spend less time with your children, it means that those children, probably because they're getting less parental time, are possibly struggling at school. There are so many social impacts to this. It's not only about the amount of money you actually get from your pay packet, it's all the knock-on effects of a society that doesn't really understand the value of giving people a wage they can live a decent life on. I personally think that things can only get better, I'm going to grit my teeth here, if we have a Labour government after the next election. I'm assured by Ken Livingstone that Edmund Bann's a wonderful guy, and that he cares very deeply about a lot of these issues. But the fact is, politics now is very, very interesting, and it's only by a wider acceptance of the fact that inequality is bad for all of us, not just for the people at the bottom who are struggling, but it's bad for all of us, as per the spirit level, that I think we can see any changes in politics. It's going to be very hard with this potential coalition alliance, whatever we're going to see after May the 7th. But the fact is, there are opportunities there to actually bring in some measures that could make a real difference and perhaps just slightly rebalance our society.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Mariana Massa. No, Danny, you're doing, are you?
Yep.
Okay, no one tells me a bloody thing at least. Okay, our next speaker isn't Mariana. Our next speaker is Danny Dorling. Danny, your title now is Professor of Human Geography at Oxford. Go on.
Thank you. If you went first, I wouldn't have enough to say. It's a great honour to be here. Andrew doesn't know that he was the person who first invited me to come to a committee room in this house, and that's part of my education to realise that this place isn't that scary or necessarily that well organised. And it's lovely to speak after Jenny and to understand that, I mean, if you want one definition of what it is to be green, you don't talk about London house prices if you're green, so you don't worry too much about what the average London house price is. It's not the standard middle-class conversation. If you were properly middle-class as I am in Oxford, you would know that London prices are now £514,000 exactly, and haven't you made some money on your house? We've got trickle-up. That's what we have. We don't have trickle-down, we have trickle-up. If you don't want people to know that there's trickle-up, you call it trickle-down. And it's worked. Part of the reason that the system makes us poor and then rich is that there are a group of rich people who are trying to be rich. Not all the rich are trying very hard to be rich, but a disproportionate number try quite hard, and people who are acquisitive tend to end up in that group. And they don't just acquire money and wealth, they also acquire political parties. In this case, they have the Tory Party. If you look at the funding, if you look at who goes to the balls, we have a political party, which is a party that represents the rich. But that's only a tiny part of the story, because over time, The amount that the acquisitive are allowed to take varies when they are controlled better, and at the moment we're doing a very bad job of controlling them. And it also varies across space. So in this country, the very rich are taking a lot. In every other country in Europe, those at the top are taking a lower proportion of what there is to be shared out. People are doing a better job of controlling the greedy. You will always have greedy people. There will always be people who can't understand the need to share and who think that everybody else thinks like them and wants to have more and more and more. It's just that you're all losers and they're a winner. And we can do some nice things for losers. We can have charity and philanthropy and so on. But I'm afraid the bulk of society is made up of losers and we've just got to accept it. That is how a set of people think. It is not easy to change their minds. It is not impossible to control them. I personally blame my parents' generation. This is somewhat unfair. But if you look at when different European countries changed, it was in the 1970s. And if you had been able to tell activists in the 1970s just how important it was to win those battles then, and what the effects in the 80s, 90s and so on would have been of a failure to do that, you never know, people might have tried a bit harder. It isn't just that, though, to be fair to that generation, although there aren't many from that generation here. There are other problems with Britain. We had an empire. The richest countries on the earth tend to be very unequal. Inequality is very expensive. It's quite hard to afford. So the US is now incredibly unequal. Having an empire alters the way you think. Losing an empire is very traumatic for people at the top of society. And if you're looking at part of the legacy of this, part of the reason we're now so unequal, the rich have so much, is that they were trying to compensate for becoming poorer relative to the rich of the rest of the world. Why am I standing here? I'm sure one of you are thinking. I'm hardly badly paid. I have a mortgage. So aren't I lucky? It's really odd to get to a point now where if you're allowed to take out a massive debt, you're seen as lucky. But one day, that debt will probably be paid off. Almost no matter what I say here, my employer's probably not going to sack me. Although you don't know, they could do. But when that debt is paid off, and I am one of these few, this tiny group of property owners, what happens then? Unfortunately, I've got children. More than one. What are they going to do? Even if the property I have ends up being worth a lot of money if I pay that mortgage off, if I cut it into thirds for my children, they can't have a home. And I don't just have children, I've got friends, I've got family, I've got other people. And because I'm not in the 1%, although I'm not far off it, I don't have so much money that I can look after the people around me with my wealth. What I'm trying to say is that what's happened to our society has now affected people so far up the income structure that it ought to be possible to get a degree of solidarity. And statistically, amazingly, the split occurs at around the 99 and 1%. 1.27% if you want to get very geeky about it. We are heading back to the past. We are rapidly heading to a renting society where the majority of people rent to landlords and rent for their entire lives. That is what the statistics are now showing about 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds across the whole of England. A quarter of all families with children in England are now renting from a private landlord. And the problem with that, well, there are many problems, but you can be evicted with 2 months' notice. Your kids have to move school and they have to find a new set of friends again and again and again. And this is families with children. It's much higher here in London. I think the way it divides is like this. There's 1% of the haves. They really do have. It's a very divided group, the 1%. There's more inequality within the 1% than in the other 99%. But there's a group of haves. They do have wealth, they do have money. There's about another 9% of us, and that includes most of us sitting here, and probably many of you, and if not yet, it'll be you in 10 years' time, there's a 9% beneath the 1% who are the might-haves. If you behave yourself well, if you're good, you might get that home. You might get that permanent job. You might be able to get a pension out of renting out that second home you buy to somebody else whose rent will pay for your pension. Now, it won't work. That group can't all become the haves the way that society has divided, but it's possible to divide people up in that way. And then there's 90% who are the have-nots. But many people in the have-nots don't realise they're the have-nots. And you can tell that 90% that the reason they don't have things that their parents used to have, security their parents used to have, lack of precarity in housing their parents used to have, is because of the immigrants. And you can get away with that at an incredible level. It was only in the 2010 general election that immigration wasn't the first thing on voters' lips, the average voter's lips, and that was because we had the most almighty economic crash just before the 2010 election. So we can keep inequality high and sustain it as long as we get people to worry about immigrants and blame them for the situation they're in, rather than inequality, which is the real problem. Three things you can do, and then I'll end with five specific policies and stop. One thing you can do is just wait for a crash. If you allow societies to become like this, and this has been studied by the World Bank amongst others, if you allow a society to pull apart and become more and more and more unequal, eventually things break, they go wrong, they become unsustainable. You get riots, you get trouble, you get violence, but I mean, I'll tell you my silly scenario on this. My silly scenario, it was as a young lad once called Gideon. And this young lad called Gideon, around about the age of 12 or 13, decided he was going to bring the whole system down. And the first thing he did is decide to change his name to George, because Gideons don't bring the system down. Weedles his way, which wasn't hard given his background, into the party of the rich, became chancellor, and then spent all the money he could, taxpayers' money, doing whatever he could to get house prices going as high as possible. Helped to buy $130 billion guarantee on loans. Changed stamp duty. Allowed pensioners to take all their annuities. Only rich pensioners have annuities. But allowed them to take their annuities and buy flats. Invent an ISA. Helped buy ISA at the last minute. Do everything you possibly can to get house prices rising to levels they've never been seen at before compared to average wages. Get them up to 16 times average wages in Oxford. Get them rising 20-odd%. Get them over 500,000. Try to get that slope going just like Tokyo in 1988-89, just before the world's largest ever property crash. Now, you could sit back and just say, let them do it, let them get away with it, it will all fall apart, and then we will have something new. I don't prescribe to this as a way of arguing, but it is not a completely silly argument, because those countries in the world which are more equal tended to have become more equal out of catastrophe. The fastest way to greater equality is to lose a war. The first thing you do as an invading army is you take the land off the aristocracy and you spread it out. That's one option, and I've got some respect for people who say, just let them make a huge mess and then we'll deal with the other side. The other side I've got a great deal of respect for is the Greens. I was in Whitney last night talking with the Greens about. And the Greens, you produce a manifesto which says what a wonderful world you could have. You could have citizens' income, you can do this, you can do that, and so on. And it's great, but it's very, very hard. You're not going to get into power for 10 or 20 years, even if you do very well the way that Britain is at the moment. But you can look to how Greens got into power in Germany. You have to start working at some point in that getting. Or you can do the third one, which is tweaking. The third one is you tweak things. So I'm going to give you my five tweaks and then I'll shut up. And these are tweaks that I'm in favour of. Education. The tweak is you take £9,000 a year tuition fees, which half of all young women in Britain are now paying, because half of young women go to university, and you reduce it to £6,000. It's a tweak. But a real lack of support for even doing that. It's a third of the way to reducing it to zero, a normal German education fee. But it's a tweak which has been suggested by the Labour Party. Secondly, on housing, three-year tenancies without allowing people to raise the rents for those 3 years suddenly slows down all those investors who are trying to make a quick buck. Again, it's Labour Party policy. If you're feeling depressed about these things, the party, I'm not a member of any party, but that party has actually managed to come up with that. But George Osborne, even he, this is why I worry that he's not trying to get this crash, even George has instigated capital gains tax on non-doms when they buy property, but only from, I think it's this month onwards. And I've got a feeling if he gained power in the majority government, he'd get rid of it. But you can do that on housing. On work, you need a living wage, but the living wage is not much use if you don't have a living rent. If the rent just keeps on rising, what was the point of getting the living wage? You also need maximum wages. My preference is 8-1 maximum wages, but 20-1 was in the Hutton Review. 20-1 is what's in Ireland now for the public sector. And you essentially don't pay anybody 20 times more than somebody at the bottom in the public sector. And you do not hire the services of any private firm which breaks that 20-1 ratio. There'll be a huge amount of work for nice accountants who are not members of the Big Four if you do that. But you need maximum wages as well as minimum wages to cope with these things. I think the argument is 8-1 or 20-1. On poverty, it's my fourth one, a policy that I don't know why Labour can't adopt, an aspiration, there should be no need for any food banks in 5 years' time. Why not just say we have an aspiration that we will do things such that people do not have to go begging for food to food banks in 5 years' time? There were no food banks 10 years ago. There were food banks or soup kitchens in the 1930s when we were last this unequal. And finally, and slightly more radically, because I also like the National Health Party, what do you do on health? And I think what you do on health, and you may have to wait for a crash or a crisis, and we're predicted a lot of them. You just look at what's happened, what's predicted to happen in Europe in the banking system and so on. You wait for a crash or a crisis, and at the point of a crash or a crisis, you say, that's it, the PFI contracts are null and void. You get rid of them. You can only do these things when you run out of money. But when you run out of money, you stop paying the PFI contracts. Even credibly threatening that you might do this will have an effect. And you have to return the National Health Service to being a National Health Service and not a vehicle for people to make money from private companies. But those kind of things may only be possible in the advent, just in the aftermath of economic turmoil. But if we have no plans for economic turmoil, if we have no imagination of what would we do if there was a run on the pound, if one of our banks crashed, if there was a chain of crashes in Europe, if Greece left the euro, or if we just went and had a referendum. Try to imagine what happens if we have a referendum about leaving Europe, which is possible. The university I work in, 36% of our income comes from Europe. I mean, Oxford will probably survive, but it's not going to be the same kind of place anymore. A referendum on Europe could be your fastest way to getting the kind of economic crash that would make it necessary to do a whole series of things which are necessary anyway, but are not seen as possible. But people need to talk about them and have them with aspirations. Otherwise, you will have what happened after 2008-09, which is the group of people who are greedy and acquisitive saw it as an opportunity to take more and more and more, and they did that, and they got away with it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony. I've got to leave and go to another meeting. Jeremy Corbyn, my comrade, ally, etc., is going to take over the chair. Yes. Come on, then. Okay. We'll vote. All those in favour of Jeremy Corbyn taking the gun? Thank you very much.
People let me down again.
Try and defy the people. Our final speaker, and I'm sorry I'm going to miss her, is Mariana Mazzucato.
Mazzucato.
She's the Professor in Economics of Innovation at the University of Sussex and General Star of Newsnight, etc. Well done. Thanks for coming.
So we have to stand up, yeah? Is that for the people in the back? Okay. Right, so 10 minutes, right? I'm going to make sure I don't go over 10 minutes. So I guess you could sum up what I'm about to say in one sentence, which is that the big critique that we've all heard about what happened, if you want, just before the crisis, during the crisis, and after the crisis, has to do with the power of these wealth extractors, the speculators, the rent seekers. And my view is that because that has not actually been accompanied by a real alternative theory of where the hell does wealth come from, value come from in the first place, actually things are only getting worse. You cannot have critiques based on value extraction without an alternative theory of value creation. And I want to sort of focus in the very limited time I have on, if you want, four key points which would helpfully get us closer to a proper theory of, if you want, a broader theory of wealth creation, which would actually allow us to seriously undermine some of the key causes of inequality, of rising inequality. Okay, so part of what I'm going to do is actually redefine some terms that are often thrown out there and are actually, again, facilitating the value extraction precisely because we're not actually challenging the terms themselves. The first term is the market, right? Now, you often hear by some of the most dysfunctional companies, for example, the seriously financialized companies that Andrew was talking about in the beginning, that, you know, yeah, they sometimes behave badly, but hey, it's the market that's forcing them to, right? Somehow the boogeyman. For example, one really dysfunctional financialized policy of many companies is just how much money they spend on areas like share buybacks, right? They make a lot of money, say the Fortune 500 companies, the top energy companies like Exxon, top IT companies like Cisco have been spending over the last 15 years, sometimes even more than their total net earnings on share buybacks, actually dipping into their reserves. Why do they do that? They are buying back their stocks to boost their stock options, which of course boosts executive pay, which is one of the key ways, you know, that people have talked about the whole 1%, 99% thing. And when they're critiqued about this, they say, oh yeah, okay, fine, we do it, but so does everyone else, because the market, right, is causing us to focus on our stock price. And first of all, that's just utterly wrong. Okay, why is that wrong? Because what is the market? The market is an outcome, right? It's an outcome of the interactions between different types of agents. Different types of businesses, small, medium, and large, different types of public sector institutions, and I'm actually going to focus a lot on that element in a second, and of course households, which can or may not make decisions, for example, to invest in their kids, say, human capital, education, etc. Now, by looking at markets as outcomes, then immediately the focus of policymakers should actually be on precisely those actors. You know, what kind of businesses do we actually want? What kind of public sector institutions do we actually need? What kind of households should we be able to support? And especially, what kind of interactions between them do we think are going to actually produce the kind of outcomes, market outcomes, that we all, you know, want, right? Now, why is that important? Because, you know, first of all, as soon as you look at any sector, and I tend to look a lot at sectors, I do something called Economics of Innovation, Industrial Dynamics, take telecommunications. You immediately see huge heterogeneity in how companies are behaving. So the number one company, I bet none of you know the number one company in telecoms, shout out.
Comcast?
No. Huawei, Chinese company, no share buybacks. Number two, Ericsson, no share buybacks. Number three, and I'm talking about broadly defined telecoms as a sector, Cisco, massive share buybacks. Okay, and again, there's lots of literature saying why this is problematic, and I'll again touch on it later, just in terms of, you know, you can make choices to invest in R&D and human capital or in just boosting your stock price. You know, already there, one should start asking, are there huge differences in corporate governance, and what kind of company should this particular sector that gets massive subsidies and massive also investments by the public sector, what kind of deal should there be between those companies and the public sector? You know, in terms, again, of these kind of subsidies, again, that Andrew was talking about. Anyway, that's the first point. Markets are outcomes. And immediately when you say that, the market is no longer a boogeyman, but we should be focusing on those outcomes and the actors and the interactions. Two, focusing on the public sector part, which I've just written this book called The Entrepreneurial State, precisely to debunk this myth of the bureaucratic, you know, dinosaur state. The really interesting thing is that economists, who unfortunately really inform lots of policymaking, have no clue whatsoever how to actually talk about that public part in that market creation process I just mentioned. At best, we talk about the role of the public sector through its different types of institutions as fixing market failures, which is like really lame, you know. I mean, if you're a top graduate from whether it's Oxford or Birmingham or whatever, why would you want to just go fix the market, right? You want to create the market. So if you actually want to actually, you know, bring great thinkers into government, it might be interesting to start changing the way we talk about government. Because at best we talk about the role of public policy as facilitating, de-risking, incentivizing, leveling the playing field, creating the conditions for these wonderful businesses to then go do their thing. When actually, if you look at the history of the few regions and the few countries of the world that, for example, have achieved innovation-led growth, what you have actually had is lots of different public sector institutions actively and directly investing in areas that create and shape markets. They do not just fix them. The usual example I give is the iPhone. You know, what makes your iPhone smart and not completely idiotic is obviously what you can do with it. And everything you can do with it, whether it's the internet, GPS, touchscreen display, Siri, were all fundamentally created by different types of government organizations, unfortunately very much related to the military-industrial complex. If you're interested in the details, buy my book. But what's very interesting also is this is just as true in health. If you take all the drugs that have actually come out, medicines that have come out in the last 10 years, and divide them up on whether they're really revolutionary drugs or slight variations of an existing drug, Viagra, different color, different dosage, something like 75% of these really revolutionary new drugs actually have come out of public funds like the National Institutes of Health in the US, which just last year spent $32 billion on, you know, the pharmaceutical and the biotechnologies underlying knowledge base, or in the UK, the Medical Research Council. So same thing with energy. If you use Bloomberg New Energy Finance, you to look at who's actually investing in the really revolutionary parts of green tech today, it turns out it's four public banks, China's, Brazil's, Germany's, and the European Investment Bank. Again, we have no way to talk about this as economists, because we just talk about this kind of market-fixing role. Now, why does this matter for inequality? Well, if you talk about the public sector, and by that I mean taxpayer-funded different institutions, which of course would include things like the BBC, right? I'm not just talking about DARPA's funding of the internet, then that's going to affect how you talk about who actually deserves the wealth that then comes from those kind of investments. And there's lots of money and profits that come out of the biotech boom, the internet boom, and you can bet that very soon the whole clean tech thing will produce lots of profits. And the question is, well, who deserves them? Who created that wealth? And so if you have a really limited view of, you know, you have all these businesses, so Steve Jobs, 800 pages of a wonderful biography that even my son, who's sitting in the back of the room there, I forced him to read, not one page, not one paragraph, not one sentence, not one word on the story I just told you about, you know, huge public money being thrown at making that iPhone smart. So what you have is things like, in the US, and very similar dynamic in the UK, the National Venture Capital Association, and the venture capitalists themselves, who are actually better than the private equity industry, which in this country, unfortunately, are not even differentiated tax reasons in tax terms. But anyway, the National Venture Capital Association in the US was able to lobby governments in just 5 years, from 1976 to 1981, think of the Piketty curve, to reduce capital gains tax by 50%, from 40 to 20%, in the name of we're the wealth creators, we're the risk takers, we're the innovators, right? So you need to reduce our tax if you want some sort of innovation-led economy. And you need a communist like Warren Buffett to remind government, wrong, you know, capital gains actually does not affect investment. You invest where you see an opportunity. And so much of these opportunities that I've been studying over time have actually really been created actively by government. By not having a framework through which to talk about that, you get lots of value extraction through this kind of lobbying. Another quick example is, of course, these share buybacks that I mentioned. They are justified through a theory that we teach business students all over the world called shareholder value theory. And the idea there is that, you know, you know, everyone works and whatever, but some people have a guaranteed rate of return. Workers, we're told, have a guaranteed rate of return, right? They get a salary, which is guaranteed. Government, banks even, we're told, have some sort of guaranteed rate through the interest rate. The only ones who don't are the shareholders. They are residual claimants. What does that mean? If you know, once everyone has been paid, if there's anything left over, the residual, they're allowed, you know, to take it. And of course, there's a massive residual in those kind of booms that I mentioned, which are all driven by technology. And so that's, of course, false. None of these people have a guaranteed rate of return. The government had a guaranteed rate of return when it invested in the internet? Of course not. For every internet, you have 20 Concords. Same thing with Tesla. Tesla, the new hero of Silicon Valley, with Elon Musk, got a $465 million guaranteed loan from Obama. Everything went well. Solyndra, $500 million. Things went bad. The taxpayer picks up the bill for Solyndra, complains, forgetting that they also invested in Tesla. But the statistics out there are basically that for every Tesla, you have 10 Solyndras. Any venture capitalist will tell you that. The problem is that because we don't admit that the government has also been an investor, not just a spender, not just a regulator, not just an administrator, de-risker, you know, incentivizer, then we haven't even thought of government's portfolio. And what it should be doing, perhaps, is thinking more directly about the return. Now, economists will tell you that the return simply happens through tax, right? The government funds all this great stuff, and then, of course, all these companies pay tax, which we know is not true. But even if they did pay tax, the point is that this narrative of who the wealth creators are has reduced tax, both the corporation tax that Andrew was talking about, as well as the capital gains tax that I mentioned, but also all these different types of tax credits that we're always told are going to be really good for the economy, when there's no empirical evidence whatsoever that even things like R&D tax credits work in terms of additionality. Because what actually drives R&D spending, again, is that perception of where the future opportunities are, and that R&D tax credit's kind of going to affect your marginal decision, but it doesn't actually create that wave of investment that we know just follows active government funding. So what to do? Well, one, we shouldn't just be talking about the wealth tax. We should actually have a different theory of the wealth creation process, which would then undermine the ability of all these lobbies to constantly be asking for lower capital gains, which in this country, by the way, was the Labour government. So Tony Blair, in the name of bringing innovation to Britain, reduced the time that private equity has to be invested from 10 years to 2 years, which was, you know, completely idiotic. In order to get these tax reductions. Two, we should, again, admit the government has been an investor and perhaps should continue to be an investor and hence structure things as a portfolio and perhaps retain some equity into some of these investments or use things like income contingent loans, which we use for students, why not with business? Perhaps retain some of the golden share of the IPR, the patents, instead of this complete giveaway. But even just really obvious things like if certain drugs, medicines are publicly funded, then government should have the right to cap the price so the taxpayer doesn't pay twice. That's actually in the act called the Bayh-Dole Act, which has been used around the world, which has allowed publicly funded research to be patented, which is new. Before the 1980s, that was not possible. In the act, it actually says, of course, government should cap the price of those products that they funded. Again, otherwise the taxpayer pays twice. Government has never exercised that right. Fourth, we should, again, have a deal, not just a new deal in the Keynesian sense, but a deal in terms, you know, between government and business, both in terms of this price sense, but also in terms of reinvestment of profits. We are at a period in history where we have record hoarding levels, $2.5 trillion in the U.S., close to $2 trillion in this country, sorry, $1.6 trillion in this country. And the point is, it used to be that there was a deal even with that. So AT&T, when it was a monopoly in the U.S., government said, hey, you know, you're a monopoly, we could bash you tomorrow, but if you reinvest your profits back into the economy, into big stuff with us, you know, we'll lay off for a while. And that's where Bell Labs came from. Bell Labs is probably the most important private sector R&D company, very much co-financed by government, but it came from this kind of tense, healthy deal with government. Instead, all we hear about is, you know, government going to, you know, wanting to be business friendly, even the Labour Party now uses that term. And in the end, all this is about making sure that we actually have something like a revolving fund, which means that all this wonderful wealth that's created by things like smart innovation-led growth actually comes back and can be reinvested into things like education, healthcare, right? Because it's all, you know, it's not a trade-off. You don't say either we do welfare, poverty alleviation, or we do innovation. In fact, if you think of it as an investment with a return, you can actually start funneling these things into all these areas, which we know also create growth because of Wilkinson's wonderful work, like that health is good for growth. Anyway, I could say more, but that's it.